Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Hi, Luli. You'll never guess where I am. Let me tell you, I'm in Chicago, the Windy City.
Oh, yes. Okay, which, fun fact, as I'm sure you know, Felicity, isn't the windiest place in the US. The name
really?
Comes, I know that you'll know this, and I'm sure our listeners will as well, yeah, from the 19th century journalists accusing local politicians of being full of hot air.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, actually. They told me about it when I arrived. So New York papers apparently coined the term during the 1893 World's Fair bid. So yeah. Windy City was about politicians going on, not about the breeze.
Okay, so about bragging. So do I then do the corny joke, which is, should we expect bragging and hot air from you on this episode, Felicity?
No, you should not do the corny joke. You should not do it. Where have you been? Let's turn the camera to you.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that was bad. Okay, so I'm just back from Spain, actually, where I had a first for me in the new drinks department, which was a blue wine, and quite literally, I mean, kind of electric blue-coloured Moscato, and which set me back the grand total of €2.75.
You go all out. I like that about you, Luli. So what did it taste like?
It was really challenging to kind of drink blue wine. But anyway, we're going to come on to that a little bit more later on.
I once did a story on blue wines.
Oh, of course you did, Felicity. So I'm going to halt you there from telling us all about that. And I promise that we'll come back to it later. So the reason that I was trying blue wine is because this week we are doing an episode all about wines of different colour. And I thought it would be really good to add to the colour mix with blue.
Oh, right. So I'm taking it this is a sign that you have once again done an enormous amount of research for this podcast episode.
Only the best for you, Felicity, and for our podcast listeners. So diving straight into this week's question, which came in from Adele, and she is based in Australia. So thank you for sending the question, Adele. We really appreciate it. Actually, Adele sent two questions. This is one of them. And the other one's also really great. So I'm going to bank that one for a future episode, Felicity.
I can't wait.
So yeah, I know. So Adele has a multi-part question. So she asks, why is red wine considered more prestigious than white wine? So she continues, historically, whites once held the crown. So when did the tables turn?
Oh, good. A Freakonomics style question. I like these ones.
We love these. So here's the kicker, Adele continues. With consumers moving away from big, heavy reds today, could white become the prestige choice again?
Ah, prestige and price tags. Good question. Let's get into it.
Okay, let's dive in. So I am going to hand over to you to start off with, to lead on the history of this one, Felicity, as our resident history correspondent. I know that you will know lots about the history. So dive in. Tell us why red wines have become more prestigious than white.
Okay, so the prestige of any wine always rests on whether it can age or not. And the reason for this is if wines could age well, they could be transported and they could be traded. And then, you know, that has all sorts of consequences, such as you need a cellar if you're going to collect them.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course. So I guess then having a cellar basically is a kind of sign of wealth.
That's right. So even back in the Roman days, it was wines that aged, that lasted and which travelled, which were prestigious. And so these were red wines. And red wine actually has always mostly been the wine of prestige. So it's the ability to move around, which is what confers the prestige on wine. And so red wine is the one that can age. Do you know why?
Well, I'm assuming because in red wine, the skins and the seeds are kind of part of the process, picking up the tannins and the phenolics, so basically protecting from oxidation, so effectively stopping the wine turning into vinegar.
Exactly. So it's chemistry that makes this possible. And it's chemistry that built the first you know, prestige system. This simple fact of aging means that a whole structure could grow up around red wines. You could sell them in barrel or in bottle, and you could transport them for long distances. Mm. So that meant you needed salespeople. You needed people to make barrels. You needed people to make cellars. You needed glass blowers, and you needed wine experts who could characterize one red wine as being better and therefore more deserving of a higher price than another.
Okay, so a rich person in England or a merchant in Holland could basically show off their wealth and power by having a cellar full of French red wines, kind of like much like the Romans did, I suppose.
Yeah, the Romans, by the way, planted grapes all the way to modern-day Romania and Moldova. But you don't hear a lot about those wines because not only was France and Italy geographically more suitable for Vitis vinifera, but the French made a conscious decision to be excellent at wine.
Well, there's a jolly good conscious decision to make.
Yeah, so I should say those places also predominantly make white wine, but a lot of wine history is about who can get to market and who can't. So wine from Burgundy, for example, was always highly valued inside France, but they struggled to export it because it had to travel overland, which was difficult and expensive.
Whereas Bordeaux was on a port, so easier for them to sell their wines and effectively export, build up an export business.
That's right. And what's really interesting is when the Bordelais began to realise that they were making money from wine being shipped through the port. So people were, like the accountants were keeping an eye on what was going in and out, and they noticed that wine was making a lot of money. But a lot of the wine in the early days that was passing through the port actually came from southwest France, from places like Cahors, you know, which is where Malbec comes from. So once they noticed this, they actually blocked all those other wines and they ramped up production in Bordeaux.
Okay, so if we hadn't had the beady-eyed accountants working this one out, Malbec might have been more famous a lot earlier if they'd had a route to market. But I suppose does that mean then that the wines of Bordeaux weren't better than others, but they just had this kind of more accountants and better logistics?
Well, in a way, it actually doesn't matter. We always think about, you know, which wine tastes the best. But actually other things, you know, shape wine as well. So the Bordelais had two key strengths as well as their route to market. They had land-owning aristocrats who were interested in prestige but also interested in making money. And they had a system of merchants who could sell the wine.
So these are two really kind of key assets for generating market demand. So do you think the wines were better than the ones they blocked? Back to my kind of previous question.
I think the thing is who knows? Because the Bordelais had money and expertise, they were able to spend a lot of money and effort on improving the wines and improving the reputation.
Yeah, and making what the market wanted. So I guess it's easy for us to assume that wine is just sort of whatever comes out of the ground from the vineyards, from the grapes. But winemakers and traders, as we're talking about here, make sure that wine style matches the market demand.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think we would all recognise that some wines are higher quality than others. And the Bordelais, they spent a lot of time and effort making sure the viticulture was improved and you know, exploring new techniques. So, you know, pretty soon, I'm sure their wines were markedly better than other wines. But they also changed the styles for their key markets as the market demanded. So the two key markets were Britain and then Holland, and they both had quite different taste. And then you saw this again in the Parky era of the 90s, where they began to produce these rich, bold styles because, you know, he would give them high scores and they could sell.
Yeah. So speaking of market, so I saw some really interesting data published by the American Association of Wine Economics recently showing that in 1960, 58%, so kind of pushing up to two-thirds of Bordeaux's vineyard area was planted to white grapes and hybrids. So my question when I saw that was, how does that square with all the money that they were making, according to their accountants, from the red wines?
Well, so the whites and the hybrids were really serving the domestic market. They were cheap and they were readily available, and they were fine as long as they were drunk young in their local region. And they could be distilled into brandy, so they were ready cash cow. But more importantly, you could grow them on land that was less prestigious and, you know, so not as expensive as the high quality red wine land.
Yeah, so that impacts land prices, I guess, also as well. So the kind of cheap and cheerful whites that you were just referring to there, you could grow them on this less prestigious land.
Yes, land prices are also part of this. The more expensive the land, the more important it was to use it for red grapes.
So what happened to all those vineyards in, say, the Robert Parker era when red wines were on the rise?
Well, white grapes were pulled out in a lot of regions and replanted with red, and the reverse is now happening as white wines increase in value.
Yeah, and we'll pick up on white wine's rise in popularity shortly, shall we? But before that, I just wanted to go kind of back to something you mentioned earlier. So you talked about, we've talked about France basically delivering the kind of prestigious red wines, but France isn't the only country making red wines, of course. So you mentioned Italy, which historically, as did Spain, produced lots of red wine. So why didn't their wines become prestigious in the international markets until relatively recently?
Well, again, it's all about route to market. So there's an MW, Pedro Ballesteros, who gives a wonderful talk, or he did a few years ago, about its transport and the market that makes terroir, not the soil. So if the market doesn't recognise you, then all you have is a local wine, regardless of how good the people in the region think the wine is.
Yeah, so they had the same problem in Burgundy then, getting their wines to the global market.
Yeah, well, at least Burgundy was within striking distance of Paris, so it could build its reputation, you know, inside a great metropolis that was itself the tastemaker of the world. Plus, they were backed by the church, and powerful rulers were very interested in them. But this wasn't true for other places. So Pedro pointed out that Rioja really emerges as an internationally recognised region in the late 19th century because they introduced the railway, so the wines could actually get out of the region.
So a literal route to market, as in a way.
That's right. And that's when people suddenly discovered how good the wines were.
Okay, so Italy, what's the story there?
Oh, well, the problem is that for most of the 19th century and for the first half of the 20th century, the Italians themselves weren't interested in export markets. And this meant they never emphasised high quality. So for most of that period, what came out of Italy was bulk production.
But they had great wines like Barolo.
That's true. But Barolo and Barbaresca are tannic monsters that sometimes needed, you know, decades to soften, which made them very difficult to export, even in a world where aging and decanting were normal practices.
And I guess they didn't create the quality hierarchies that the French did. So like I'm thinking here, like the 1855 classification of Bordeaux and the Cru of Burgundy. And these quality systems give clear signals to consumers and the trade of quality kind of hierarchy.
Yeah, exactly right. So these classification systems, interestingly, were basically price guides, even though they're shrouded in romanticism. Mm. So the 1855 Bordeaux classification, which is the most famous in the world, was drawn up for the Paris Exposition. And it was done by asking merchants to provide their price guides. And so the top prices became the first growths that were exhibited and so on. And it was one of many such classifications that existed in Bordeaux. But that one became the official one because it was printed in the catalogue.
Okay, so there's a good reason to have something printed so it kind of literally kind of stands up the test of time. So these quality hierarchies then, particularly the one we're talking about here, really do act as commercial hierarchies from a price perspective.
Yeah, they're always about money. So in the case of Burgundy, it was a tax hierarchy. Yeah. So the monks had carefully recorded which vineyards produced the best wines and got the highest prices. And the pre-revolutionary government taxed wine depending on the region and the quality. And after the revolution, the government kind of thought this was a good idea. And so they standardised the system.
Okay, so there's like a kind of penalty then for producing better wine that's going to come at a higher tax rate. So I guess careful what you wish for. So they knew how much tax to collect, which I suppose is always really handy for them as well.
Yeah. But anyway, so to sum up, the importance of these recognised hierarchies is that it gives buyers great confidence in what they're buying. So today, European regions are always adding new classifications to try and give their wines a hierarchy, which of course actually makes it more complicated.
Yeah. And then you get to consumer confusion. Okay. So let's sum up where we've got to so far. So red wines became prestigious because the way they're made enables them to be aged. And because they can be aged, they can be traded. And inevitably, this leads to a system that recognizes that some wines get higher prices than others. But at this point, Felicity, can I take us back into kind of thinking about defining what prestige is a little bit more? Because we've kind of been banding that term around, haven't we?
You've got academic papers somewhere in your library that you're going to pull out, I can tell. Yes. Yes. Tell us about prestige, Luli.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I have. You know me. I did do other research other than a €2.75 blue wine for this episode. So the term prestige gets thrown around constantly when, you know, as I just said, we've been doing that on this episode, so guilty as charged. So in academic sociology circles, prestige means or is defined as a social esteem that's freely conferred by others. And I think that's the really important bit, is it's not the same as power or money. It's what you get when people admire something, and it's a collective admiration that's built up.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is prestige is social currency. So it's one of the three that sociologists say run society: power, wealth, and prestige.
Exactly, absolutely. So we should turn to Pierre Bourdieu at this point. And again, apologies for my usual butchering of French pronunciation. Some things never change, Felicity. Anyway, he is the French sociologist who's widely considered one of the most influential in the late 20th century, but especially for introducing the concepts such as cultural capital and symbolic power and analysing these in terms of taste and class and consumption.
Yeah, his name comes up a lot. So I'm going to be interested to hear how his insights relate to wine.
So in his book Distinction, written in 1979, he argued that what we call good taste isn't about personal preference. It's about social signalling. So people use taste to mark themselves as belonging to a certain group, or at least aspiring to belong to a certain group. So just to clarify there, when he is talking about taste, he's meaning kind of taste for music or for art, not just the literal taste as we would get in wine, for example.
So it's aesthetic decisions. But it's also when somebody says they just prefer Burgundy over Barossa Shiraz.
Yeah, exactly. So what they might be really saying is, I'm kind of part of the group that values scarcity and restraint and cultural capital, symbolized in the example you've just used by wine from Burgundy as opposed to Barossa. So he continues that these taste signals create a kind of hierarchy, and at the top sits what's rare, subtle, hard to access, and crucially recognized by others as being high status.
Okay, so that's why prestige is often just exclusivity dressed up as discernment.
Yeah, exactly. And the Champagne world is a great case study of this. So prestige cuvées Dom Pérignon, Cristal, etc., are defined less by their flavour and more by their symbolic scarcity. So they're produced in smaller quantities or heavier or more glamorous bottles, and priced at levels that basically say, this is not for everyone.
So we admire them because other people admire them.
Yeah, exactly. So prestige is sort of socially contagious. So if a certain group confers esteem, everyone tends to copy it. So sociologists call this the cumulative advantage, or the Matthew effect. To those that have, more will be given. So the spark of recognition snowballs and becomes kind of entrenched into prestige.
Oh, okay. So it's like once a few critics call something the best, it becomes the benchmark, even if the taste isn't objectively superior.
Exactly. And that's the illusion that he's kind of unpacking. And he argues that what we call taste is this sort of social performance. So we learn to like things from our group or the groups we emulate, as I said earlier, to consider it refined.
Okay, so this is why white wine is also often less seen as less prestigious, even though technically it can sometimes be as complex as red. It's just coded as lighter, easier, more feminine.
Oh, okay, you threw that one in there, Felicity. So now you're talking.
That's not my opinion. That's not my opinion, by the way, but that's a word that I often hear, and it annoys me, of course. But anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
No, I'm picking up on your really interesting use of the word feminine there in terms of associating that with white wine. So at the risk of raising objections to us, Felicity, on this podcast, do you think there's an undervalued prestige in white wines because they are perceived as being more feminine and therefore potentially less valuable? Discuss.
Normally my answer would be a swift yes, because things that are coded as feminine are always undervalued. In the case of white wine is such a modern phenomenon that I think that is, if it is part of the story, it's a small part of the story.
Okay. So maybe this is a good segue then to kind of move more into white wines and at the moment. So right now, we can say that prestige systems serve a purpose. They create shortcuts, signals, and help people navigate choice and uncertainty.
That's right. So if you don't know much about wine, you can just go and buy the one with the gold, you know, label on it or the French name.
Yeah, and it basically prestige sort of reduces the cognitive load is effectively what we're saying. So sort of trust me, all others already have. But there's a twist because prestige is built on social recognition. It can't really be faked easily, well, at least not for long. So people try to manufacture prestige, but without the cultural backing that kind of is needed to come with it.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other interesting story about fakes and so on. But anyway, we'll leave that for another day. So how does prestige evolve?
Well, slowly until it doesn't. So sometimes new groups kind of rewrite the hierarchy. So an example, so think back to our last episode on natural wine. So we could say that what used to be dismissed as faulty when it comes to wine has become the kind of prestige marker of authenticity amongst a new cultural elite or a new generation of wine drinkers and winemakers.
Yeah. And of course, what we should also say is that once something has acquired prestige, it typically attracts money, which can change the nature of the thing. So if you go back to wine, prestige accrued to those red wines that were circulating within the international trading system, not just because they were known quantities and could be priced effectively, but because the money they were earning went back into developing the product. The more money and care, the better the product and the more famous it became.
But within this system, particular estates and plots of land became more desirable than others. And this eventually led to classifications that cemented the prestige to specific red wines, as we were talking, kind of now inscribed into wine law, and particularly in Bordeaux and Burgundy.
That's right. And then there's the fact that the people who were buying them needed to be wealthy by the standards of the day, not just because the wines were expensive, but because you needed to store them until they were ready to drink. So the trading of wines inevitably led to the situation where the aristocracy and associated merchants were serving the aristocracy. So the prestige reinforced itself, you were just saying.
Yeah. And of course, wine is complex because it doesn't just involve particular vineyards or makers, but, you know, varies and can vary significantly, you know, every vintage. So an entire expert class who could interpret wine began to evolve from merchants and winemakers to cellar masters to wine critics. And this particularly happened at the end of the 19th and into the 20th century.
That's right. And of course, arcane expertise attracts prestige of its own. So, and what all of this adds up to is this phenomenon today where people are scared to admit they don't know anything about wine. Like we said earlier, being able to own wine was a prestige marker in and of itself because you had to have somewhere to store it, which automatically means a bigger house or estate.
Yeah. So prestige leads to more prestige, effectively, is what we're saying. We'll sum it up. So let's go back to Adele's question. We touched on white wines briefly. So how do white wines fit into all of this?
Well, once again, it's about which wines had aging potential. So because you need that before a wine can enter the trading system. So we're talking about champagne, most sweet wines in the dessert level wines, and Riesling had the ability to age. And so these wines were historically prestigious.
Okay, so let's take those one by one. So with champagne, the aging ability, as we know, comes from a few things, particularly the combination of acidity and the secondary fermentation in the bottle, which means that the wine is in contact with the yeast lees. And this not only adds flavour, but also releases antioxidants that prevent the wine from going bad.
That's right. And the other thing is historically, champagne was also a lot sweeter than it is today. And sweetness can act as a preservative because when there's a lot of sugar around, it makes it harder for microbes to survive.
I would have thought sugar would be a good feeding material.
Well, sugar creates something called osmotic pressure. So when there's a lot of sugar around, it pulls water out of other cells. So if you're a bacteria, that means you're about to get seriously dehydrated.
Poor little bacteria. Okay, I guess that's why then honey, for example, is traditionally used as an antibacterial. And if they used to use some sugar in champagne, that's nothing compared to how much sugar is in, for example, like Sauternes, the white wine from Bordeaux, or Tokaj from Hungary.
Yeah, that we should add, of course, that this isn't actual sugar in the wine we're talking about. We're talking about sweetness that's coming from the fruit. Yes, and so the aging effect comes from sugar plus acidity plus alcohol.
I always thought they were, so this is probably where I've got it wrong. I always thought they were valued because of their sweetness. But now what you're saying is I'm actually thinking it's this aging potential which is more important.
Yeah, so I guess if you were rich enough that you could afford a bottle of Sauterne and you wanted some sugar, you could just send your servants to the patisserie. So sweetness by itself doesn't explain the desirability of these wines.
Okay, but none of this explains Riesling. So as our resident, well, not today, but normally resident of Germany, tell us all about Riesling because I know you want to.
Okay, so Riesling is one of the very rare white wines that has the ability to age in some vintages. So a few years ago, I interviewed Daniel Deckers, who's a German wine journalist, but also a very noted historian. And he told me that Riesling's reputation was based on a handful of warm vintages in the 19th and 20th centuries. And this made the high-end Rieslings extremely rare and valuable. And so they commanded some of the highest prices in the world.
And yet today, Riesling can be pretty tough to sell.
Well, this is all about, you know, what you were saying about prestige. You have to protect prestige, and Germany didn't. So first of all came the World Wars, which wrecked both the country's reputation and its wine industry. And after that, winemakers chased volume over quality, replanting for higher yields. And then came the big disaster, the 1971 wine law.
Okay, what was the disaster? What went wrong?
Well, it basically lowered standards and it allowed blending without having to declare, you know, the blends on the label. So producers were also allowed to sweeten wines to make them more commercial. And that's what drove wines like, you know, brands like Blue Nun and Black Tower. They were sweet, simple and export friendly. So German shelves at home were flooded and quality collapsed and so did Riesling status. And so the Germans tried to make up for this by sending a flood of stuff abroad. And, you know, and the prestige vanished.
Yeah, hence me growing up with Blue Nun and Black Tower in our households. Anyway, that not only ages me, but also says something about what was in our household. But once a reputation sinks, it takes a long time to recover often.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, there were always great producers whose wines were sought after. But basically Germany was, you know, reputation was drowned by this flood of cheap Liebfraumilch.
Yeah, and it's ironic, isn't it? Because Riesling itself can be extraordinary. So, slight sidebar. So I've had some amazing Rieslings at the Worshipful Company and Vintners dinners, which are just beautiful and astonishingly complex. And they're amazing. And that's partly, I guess, because the vintners buyers are just like super experts and know what they're looking for and have the patience and we have the sellers to age them properly. But that's the problem, kind of outside of this specialist expertise, Rieslings can be pretty tough for sort of normal everyday consumers, particularly to navigate.
Yeah, it's for an interesting reason. It's because Riesling reflects where it comes from. So a Mosel Riesling can be very delicate and sweet, an Alsace one can be dry and, you know, powerful. So unless you really understand the category, you can't predict what it is that you're going to buy. And because it's such a individualistic wine, you can't make it into a commercial white.
Yeah, exactly, which is a classic kind of consumer trap, isn't it? Because when people face uncertainty, they rely on heuristics, so these mental shortcuts that make decision-making easier. So if a wine style varies too much, like you were just talking about, you know, even within Germany or across to Alsace, it kind of feels risky to a consumer. So it's making me think of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, for example, which we've seen, you know, exports globally grow consistently and at relatively high prices compared to other mainstream wines. And New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is that real antithesis to this. So there's less variability in the style between producers. So actually that ends up being a really good thing for consumers because it's a safer bet and easier to navigate in terms of them knowing what it is they're going to buy and get and taste.
That's right. So the very thing that wine connoisseurs value about wine, it's, you know, its variability is what makes it difficult for other people.
Yeah, so continuing with white and their side of the story, so to speak, which we were doing until I took us off track. Why aren't we hearing more about other white wines that could have prestigious connotations then?
Well, because until really recently, and I mean extremely recently, white wines couldn't age. When wine grapes are pressed, the juice isn't kept in contact with the skin, so it doesn't get these protective phenolics and tannins. So for a lot of wine history, white wine could only be drunk locally because it oxidized so easily. So if you stuck it on a boat and sent it off to London, what would appear at the other end would be cloudy and brown.
Okay, so it's funny that you say that because it makes me think about our last episode on natural wines and the arguments of, that we were discussing there about whether to use sulfur dioxide or not. And in Burgundy, winemakers used to keep SO2 to a kind of minimum and press their white wines more lightly, which meant that for years, white wines from Burgundy would prematurely oxidize, could prematurely oxidize, and the problem, so-called premox.
That's right. And it's really modern technology from the 1950s and 60s that sorted all of this out.
Ah, that's right. So in doing my research for this episode, I came across a whole list of technological turning points. And I know you love a technological turning point, Felicity.
I wouldn't expect anything less from you, Luli. So go ahead. Tell us what you found.
Okay, well, I'm going to share. So the first big breakthrough was temperature control. So being able to cool the fermentation through refrigeration systems. So amongst the first people to adopt this were the big champagne houses. We've talked about champagne quite a lot, who were fitting cooling systems to tanks by the late 1950s, which meant they could preserve freshness in their base wines for the champagne production.
Yeah, and actually we shouldn't forget the role of stainless steel tanks. Now they'd been around since the early 20th century, but the Germans and the Swiss started using them in the 1950s, also as a way of preserving freshness.
Yeah, and then if we move up to the 1960s then, this combination of cooling systems and steel tanks were becoming really widely adopted in the world of wine and in countries like Australia and the US, for example.
Okay, what's next on your list?
Okay, next, adoption of filtration. So this, as we know, is where membranes are used to filter out particles like leftover yeast or bacteria, which could otherwise spoil wine.
Yeah, and there was also, I think, a whole lot of research into fermentation and so on, all of which was aimed at preserving freshness.
Yeah, so this is where they started using or started selecting for yeast. So instead of sort of waiting for the native yeast to just kind of turn up and see what they were going to do and bring to the wine, which might also include bacteria, winemakers started buying commercial yeast so they could even choose them based on what characteristics they wanted to emphasize in the flavor of the taste of the wine.
That's right. So now they could not just guarantee freshness, but also style.
Then we have the introduction of screw caps, which reduces oxidization, and the more judicious use of our old friend sulfur dioxide. So winemakers now had a better understanding of how much to use to keep the wine fresh without overwhelming it, which struck with that kind of struck match character that we've talked about before. So is there anything I've forgotten, technologically speaking?
Well, also there was better viticulture, but there's one great piece of trivia that you haven't added.
Okay, hit me with it. What's your big bit of trivia? Go.
Okay, it is called cold chain logistics. Better shipping, basically, which meant that wine wasn't subjected to heat or wide variations in temperature en route.
Okay, I have to admit, Felicity, that's not one of your best pieces of trivia to date, I don't think.
No, it is. It's great. It's great trivia. Okay, so in the late 1990s, System Bolaget, the government-run liquor monopoly that controls the sale of alcohol in Sweden, demanded that all of its suppliers use cold chain shipping for white wines. Now, because Sweden has this huge buying power, that set the global standard.
Oh, okay.
And by the early 2000s, other major buyers like Tesco supermarket in the UK were also demanding it. And so that changed the whole world of white wine.
So once again, we have wine styles shaped less by terroir and where they're from, effectively, but more by technical and commercial decisions.
That's right. Anyway, so the end result of all of this is that the past 20 years have seen the emergence of prestige still white wines that can also command huge prices at auction, particularly from Burgundy.
Yeah, and given all the problems with keeping white wine stable, why didn't those earlier winemakers just kind of ferment their white wines on the grape skins to add the phenolics and the tannins that would allow wines to age? So I'm thinking like wines we see from Georgia or Friuli, the kind of traditional orange wines.
Well, we can blame the French for this.
Oh, okay, you said it. Okay, why are you blaming the French again, Felicity?
Because they decided they were going to be the trendsetters for luxury, and the tastemakers were the aristocrats of the court, and they prized clarity and brilliance.
Okay, so like the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles.
That's the perfect example. So when they lifted one of these newfangled, beautiful glass bottles to the light, they wanted to see clarity. So orange, brown or cloudy wines signalled the stuff that the peasants drank, so there's no way they were touching it.
Okay, they're not having none of that. So I guess the prestige white and clarity bought by Sauternes and Champagne.
That's right. So if we're talking about colour, we should also maybe mention rosé. So as we talked about in our earlier episode, rosé's wide adoption also came because of the same new technology that improved white wines so much. And also because we had tastemakers like Angelique Jolie and Brad Pitt popularising the style thanks to their Chateau Miraville brand. So modern day celebrities function the way aristocrats once did. They're contributing their halo or their prestige to products.
Yeah, and the style also took off because people love the colour, literally.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it just happened to be the millennial pink, the colour that was taking Instagram by storm about, 15 years ago.
Yeah. So now we've sort of digressed onto colour, talking about colour, Felicity, which you know is one of my favourite subjects. So let's talk about colour. So psychologists have shown again and again that colour changes how we actually taste things. So Charles Spence, who we've referenced before, an amazing researcher in this area, pulled together a load of studies done on this subject in a 2015 review, and he looked at everything from soft drinks to soup and everything, and the pattern's really clear from the evidence. So if we add a splash of colour, people's flavour judgments change. So you can take a neutral liquid, throw in some red dye, suddenly people report that it tastes sweeter, even though there's no difference. It hasn't chemically changed at all. If we shift the colour towards green, then the same liquid is thought to be more bitter or more sour. So our brains aren't just drinking with our mouths, with our taste buds. We're drinking with our eyes.
Yeah, and this is why people get tricked all the time. So researchers often add red dye to white wines. And so the people tasting, they think it's a red wine. So they report tasting strawberry and blackcurrant characters, which of course are nowhere near to be seen.
Yeah, exactly. And Spence points out that colour sets up the expectation before you've even taken that first sip. So once your brain has filled that expectation with what you're expecting, it influences hugely the perception of what you're actually tasting.
Yeah, so when we say, you drink with your eyes, it's not just a saying, it's literally measurable in psychology labs.
Yeah, exactly. Which brings us very nicely round to the blue wine I was telling you about that I bought in Spain last week, investing the pricely sum of €2.75 and all in the name of this podcast.
Well, as I said, I once wrote an article about blue wine.
Oh, here we go. Okay, so let's hear about your article. Steal my thunder, why don't you? So what did you learn, Felicity, when you did an article on blue wine?
Well, once again, it's the story of a technical breakthrough. So about a decade ago, scientists worked out how they could extract the blue colour from algae and they could turn it into a stable food dye. So suddenly there were blue drinks everywhere, particularly blue gins.
Okay, so to be honest, I thought you were going to say it was because of the butterfly pea flower. You know, the Asian flower that's used in dyes, if you add lemon juice, it goes purple. And it became kind of super trendy a few years ago. And suddenly there were these sort of deep purple cocktails everywhere.
Yeah, well, that happened at the same time, actually. And I think it's a case of something that biologists call convergent evolution, where two similar things arise simultaneously. So blue drinks were kind of in the ether, if you like. And so there was this group of young Spanish entrepreneurs and they were thinking about how to reinvent wine. And so they went, let's turn it blue.
Interesting choice.
Yeah, well, the co-founder, Aritz Lopez was his name, told me he'd been reading that book, Blue Ocean Strategy, which tells you that you should go look for open spaces. And he was like, well, blue wine is an open space. So he and his friends developed a wine called Gick.
Okay, so what, I wonder if the book had been called Green Ocean Strategy.
Yeah, maybe.
He'd have ended up with a green wine. Anyway, and what happened to Gick?
Well, I got a sample in and I tasted it and it was horrible. It was horribly sweet and simple. But I actually don't think it was the blue dye. And I don't think your horrible experience with the Moscato was because it's blue, but it's because it's a terrible wine.
Yeah. So did Gick sell well?
Well, it's 100,000 bottles in the first year. I don't know if it's still on sale, but they did develop a dye of their own, which was partly based on grape pigments.
Okay, so that sounds like quite a chemistry problem.
Well, the biggest problem they had was actually EU law, which unfortunately for them does not recognise blue wine as a category.
And for very good reason too. So that's not the blue wine that I saw. So I'm guessing it kind of must have, as a category, must have done, is doing all right, because otherwise why would other producers start producing blue wine?
Well, it's actually convergent evolution again. So there was this different group of Spanish winemakers, and they were on a balcony drinking one of these newfangled blue gins, and they decided to make a blue wine. And so one thing led to another, and pretty soon there were just loads of blue wines on the market, including for the wedding sector.
Oh, come on. Well, something borrowed something blue.
That's right. And then it was a gimmick and, you know, most of them just disappeared.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned convergent evolution there. So there's actually an evolutionary reason, I'm sure you know this, why blue food and drink often taste super weird, which can make people hesitate before we eat or drink them.
Well, you know, back in the day, weight loss companies used to tell people to put food on blue plates, as the blue would be so off-putting you'd stop eating.
Okay, I'm not sure that's worked for me, but okay. That sounds a bit like an urban myth. But it is true that, there are very few naturally occurring blue foods, kind of aside from blueberries and some rare potatoes, but very, very few. So this means that from an evolutionary point of view, our brains associate blue with mold or spoilage or toxicity. So we become instinctively wary of consuming blue stuff.
Yeah, and also, I'm wary of, consuming blue wine because it looks a lot like something that you'd use to clean. Okay, so
In your car windscreen washer wipers.
Oh, exactly. Okay, so going back to the natural world, some examples would be red typically signals sweet, like strawberries, or green would signal sour or vegetable, like limes or lettuce, as you mentioned earlier. But you're right, with blue, there's no consistent natural flavour associated with blue. So even if it's all natural, colours that come from something like anthocyanins from the grape, it's just too off-putting to try.
Yeah, and this leads to associations of blue basically being artificial. So most blue foods and drinks are artificially coloured using this dye called Brilliant Blue FCF. So because of this, the flavour is often synthetic. So, you might get like a blue raspberry drink or a made-up flavour that doesn't exist in nature, which then reinforces this kind of weirdness and disconnect in our minds.
So I guess what you're telling me is that we're never going to have an auction-worthy classification of blue wines.
No. Even Pepsi, so for the other end of the scale, even Pepsi's infamous Pepsi Blue in 2002 flopped hard in most markets because people just couldn't come to terms after the novelty value of the neon colour. And in cocktails, so Blue Curacao, sells precisely because it's kitsch and sort of tropical associated.
Oh, I want to do an episode one day just on Blue Curacao. I want to know what happened to it. Or maybe, we should take this further and do one on colour and spirits.
Oh, yes, please. I love talking about colours. Anyway, we can start here very quickly because Adele was asking us about white versus red. But let's pause for a second and think about green wine. So in Portugal, we'll find vinho verde on labels, which literally, translated is green wine. But actually, in this case, the verde here means young and fresh. So the DOC region, just northwest of Porto in Portugal, is where the wines are made. And they're made to be drunk early and fresh.
So it signals youthful spritz.
Yeah, exactly. And most people outside of Portugal know these white wines for their kind of light and crisp and sometimes mildly spritzy, often lower in alcohol. You're kind of perfect aperitivo and summer drinking. And it travels well. So nearly half of vinho verde actually gets exported outside of Portugal. So it's not just a sort of locals drink.
Yeah. So I guess what we're saying is that the colour of a wine signals a lot more than how it's going to taste. Do you want to sum up what we've covered, Luli?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. That feels like we've covered quite a lot of ground, Felicity. So the prestige of red was inevitable in a world without technology simply because reds could age and be transported. That made it something that could be traded, leading to an infrastructure of merchants, wine experts and others, all of which created its own form of prestige.
And of course, it was sold to the wealthy, which enhanced its prestige.
But once refrigeration and other technologies emerged that could keep white wines fresh, giving them the ability to be traded and shipped, the unique prestige of red over white wine started to erode. So should we also mention that today, we'd kind of alluded to this earlier, white wine is growing in popularity more or proportionally than red wine.
Okay, give me your theory on why this is.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to try and summarize it. Otherwise, I could launch us into a whole new episode, which I don't think either you or our listeners would thank me for. So try and summarize it. It's due to couple of kind of major macro trends. So increasing consumer preferences for freshness in terms of flavor and what we're eating and drinking, also combined with a trend for a desire for chilled drinks. So from the research I've done, it's also due to the fact that many regular, so everyday wine drinkers, red can actually feel quite a strong flavor due to the tannins, which we've talked about. So white wine tends to be, well, kind of more simple, literally easier to drink. And this trend is also bolstered by the fact that whereas traditionally wine was consumed with food and at meals, often our occasions are now shifting where we're consuming wine. So we might be consuming wine, say, not with a meal, so outside of meal times, or at least with less traditional, more formal meals. But as I said, I could take a whole episode, so I hope my summary was okay, and I'll quit while I'm ahead, hopefully, on this one.
Yeah, and I should. This is a good time to mention what's happening in China, actually. When wine boomed in China around about 2008-2009, it was primarily used as a prestige gift. So people were using it at you know, high-end yes. banquets, but they were also giving people these very expensive bottles of Bordeaux as a mark of prestige. And then the market kind of collapsed. Well, what's happened is that it turns out that the Chinese don't love red wines. They love white wines. It's white wines that are booming in the Chinese market, which is something that people never, ever thought they would see. Okay, so I think we've covered how prestige in wine grows from every angle. So I think we have solved the problem.
Okay, well, another question, at least attempted, shall we say, and discussed. I think solved is quite a strong statement there, Felicity. So I've got a final question to throw at you. Red or white for you?
A white wine, but I do drink very light red wines like Pinot Noir. And what about you?
So I'm kind of almost embarrassed to admit this, but I don't really like red wine. So I kind of guess, as we've been discussing, red wine is considered more prestigious. So if I admit that I don't really like it as much, I guess I'm kind of feeling like I don't have as good a taste. I don't know. Anyway, white for me, Chardonnay through and through, throw in some oak and I'm a happy lady.
I think you've got great taste, Lily. All right, let's wrap up this episode. So I think we have solved another question of drinks.
Well, thank you, Felicity. So don't forget, if you have a burning question that you would like us to solve, or at least attempt to solve, whether wine or spirits, send it in.
And write to us at aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com, and Luli will see your email when she clears the inbox.
I will. And don't forget to leave us a rating. The algorithm will thank you, and so will we. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.